Chapter 28. That afternoon, as I warmed myself by the fire, Bea told me the story of how the Angel of Mist had come into the possession of the Aldaya family. It had all the makings of a lurid melodrama, something that could well have come from the pen of Julian Carax. The house was built in 1899 by the architectural partnership of Nauli, Matorell y Bergadà, for a prosperous and extravagant Catalan financier called Salvador Jauzà, who was to live in it for only a year. The tycoon, an orphan since the age of six and of humble origins, had amassed most of his fortune in Cuba and Puerto Rico. People said that he was one of the many shady figures behind the plot that led to the fall of Cuba and the war with the United States, in which the last of the colonies were lost. He brought back rather more than a fortune from the New World. With him were an American wife, a fragile damsel from Philadelphia's high society who didn't speak a word of Spanish, and a mulatto maid who had been in his service since his first years in Cuba, and who travelled with a caged macaque in harlequin dress, and seven trunks of luggage. At first they moved into a few rooms in the Hotel Colón, while they waited to acquire a residence that would suit the tastes and desires of Jauzà. Nobody doubted for a moment that the maid, an ebony beauty endowed with eyes and a figure that, according to the society pages, could make heart rate soar, was in fact his lover, his guide to innumerable illicit pleasures. It was assumed, moreover, that she was a witch and a sorceress. Her name was Maricela, or that's what Jauzà called her. Her presence and her mysterious air soon became the favourite talking point at the social gatherings that well-born ladies held to sample sponge fingers and kill time and the autumn blues. Unconfirmed rumours circulated at these tea parties that the woman fornicated on top of the male, that is to say, rode him like a dog on heat, which violated at least five of six recognised mortal sins. In consequence, more than one person wrote to the bishopric asking for a special blessing and protection for the untainted, immaculate souls of all respectable families in Barcelona. And to crown it all, Jauzà had the audacity to go out for a ride in his carriage on Sundays, in the middle of the morning, with his wife and Maricela, parading this Babylonian spectacle of depravity in front of the eyes of any virtuous young man who might happen to be strolling along Paseo de Gracia on his way to the 11 o'clock mass. Even the newspapers noted the haughty look of the strapping woman, who gazed at the Barcelona public as a queen of the jungle might gaze at a collection of pygmies. Around that time, Catalan modernism was all the rage in Barcelona, but Jauzà made it quite clear to the architects he had engaged to build his new home that he wanted something different. In his book, different was the highest praise. Jauzà had spent years strolling past the row of neo-Gothic extravagances that the great tycoons of the American industrial age had erected on Fifth Avenue's Mansion Row in New York City. Nostalgic for his American days of glory, the financier refused to listen to any argument in favour of building in accordance with the fashion of the moment, just as he had refused to buy a box in the Liceo, which was de rigueur, labelling the opera house a Babel for the deaf, a beehive of undesirables. He wanted his home to be far from the city, in the still relatively isolated area of Avenida del Tibidabo. He wanted to gaze at Barcelona from a distance, he said. The only company he sought was a garden filled with statues of angels, which, according to his instructions, conveyed by Maricela, must be placed on each of the points of a six-point star. No more, no less. Resolved to carry out his plans, and with his coffers bursting with money, with which to satisfy his every whim, Salvador Jauzà sent his architects to New York for 3 months to study the exhilarating structures built to house Commodore Vanderbilt, the Astors, Andrew Carnegie, and the rest of the 50 golden families. He instructed them to assimilate the style and techniques of the Stanford, White and McKim firms, and warned them not to bother knocking on his door with a project that would please what he called pork butchers and button manufacturers. A year later, the three architects turned up at his sumptuous rooms at the Hotel Colón to submit their proposal. Jauzà, in the company of the Cuban Maricela, listened to them in silence and, at the end of the presentation, asked them what it would cost to complete the work in 6 months. Frédéric Martorell, the leading member of the architectural partnership, cleared his throat and, out of decorum, wrote down a figure on a piece of paper and handed it to the tycoon. The latter, without even blinking, wrote out a cheque for the total amount and dismissed the delegation with a vague gesture. 7 months later, in July 1900, Houssa, his wife and the maid Maricella moved into the house. By August, the two women would be dead, and the police would find a dazed Salvador Houssa naked and handcuffed to the armchair in his study. The report made by the sergeant in charge of the case remarked that all the walls in the house were bloodstained, that the statues of the angels surrounding the garden had been mutilated, their faces painted like tribal masks, and that traces of black candles had been found on the pedestals. The inquiry lasted 8 months. By then, Houssa had fallen silent. The police investigations concluded that, by all indications, Houssa and his wife had been poisoned by some herbal extract that had been administered to them by Maricella, in whose rooms various bottles of the lethal substance had been found. For some reason, Houssa had survived the poison, although the aftermath had been terrible, for he gradually lost his power of speech and his hearing. Part of his body was paralysed, and he suffered pains so horrendous that they condemned him to live the rest of his days in constant agony. Signora Houssa had been discovered in her bedroom, lying on her bed with nothing on but her jewels, one of which was a diamond bracelet. The police believed that once Maricella had committed the crime, she had slashed her own wrists with a knife and had wandered about the house, spreading her blood on the walls of the corridors and rooms until she collapsed in her attic room. The motive, according to the police, had been jealousy. It seems that the tycoon's wife was pregnant at the time of her death. Maricella, it was said, had sketched a skeleton on the woman's naked belly with hot red wax. The case, like Salvador Houssa's lips, was sealed forever a few months later. Barcelona's high society observed that nothing like this had ever happened in the history of the city, and that the likes of rich colonials and other rabble arriving from across the pond was ruining the moral fibre of the country. Behind closed doors, many were delighted that the eccentricities of Salvador Houssa had come to an end. As usual, they were mistaken. They had only just begun. The police and Houssa's lawyers were responsible for closing the file on the case. But the nabob Houssa wanted to continue. It was at this point that he met Don Ricardo Aldaya, by then a rich industrialist with a colourful reputation for his womanising and his leonine temper, who offered to buy the property off him with the intention of knocking it down and reselling it at a healthy profit. The value of the land in that area was soaring. Houssa did not agree to sell, but he invited Ricardo Aldaya to visit the house and observe what he called a scientific and spiritual experiment. No one had entered the property since the investigation had ended. What Aldaya witnessed in there left him speechless. Houssa had completely lost his mind. The dark shadow of Maricella's blood still covered the walls. Houssa had summoned an inventor, a pioneer in the technological novelty of the moment, the cinematograph. His name was Fructuos Gilabert, and he agreed to Houssa's demands in exchange for funds with which to build a film studio in the Bailis region. For he felt sure that, during the 20th century, moving pictures would supplant organised religion. Apparently, Houssa was convinced that the spirit of Maricella had remained in the house. He asserted that he could feel her presence, her voice, her smell, and even her touch in the dark. When they heard these stories, Houssa's servants had immediately fled in search of less stressful employment in the neighbouring Sarriá district, where there were plenty more mansions and families incapable of filling up a bucket of water or darning their own socks. Houssa, left on his own, sank further into his obsession with his invisible spectres. He decided that the answer to his woes lay in making the invisible visible. He had already had a chance to see some of the results of the invention of cinematography in New York, and he shared the opinion of the deceased Maricella that the camera swallowed up souls. Following this line of reasoning, he commissioned Fructuos Gelabert to shoot yards and yards of film in the corridors of the Angel of Mist, in search of signs and visions from the other world. Despite the cinematographer's noble efforts, the scientific pursuit of Hauzard's phantoms proved futile. Everything changed when Gelabert announced that he'd received a new type of sensitive film straight from the Thomas Edison factory in Menlo Park, New Jersey. The new stock made it possible to shoot in extremely low light conditions, below candlelight, something unheard of at the time. Then, in circumstances that were never made clear, one of the assistants in Gelabert's laboratory accidentally poured some sparkling Zarello wine from the Penedès region into the developing tray. As a result of the chemical reaction, strange shapes began to appear on the exposed film. This was the film Hauzard wanted to show Don Ricardo Aldaya the night he invited him to his ghostly abode at number 32 Avenida del Tibidabo. When Aldaya heard this, he supposed that Gelabert was afraid of losing Hauzard's funding and had resorted to such an elaborate ruse to keep his patron's interest alive. Whatever the truth, Hauzard had no doubt about the reliability of the results. Moreover, where others saw only shapes and shadows, he saw Revenant. He swore he could see the silhouette of Marisela materialising under a shroud, a shadow that then mutated into a wolf and walked upright. Alas, all Ricardo Aldaya could see during the screening was large stains. He also maintained that both the film itself and the technician who operated the projector stank of wine and other entirely earthly spirits. Nonetheless, being a sharp businessman, the industrialist sensed that he could turn the situation to his advantage. A mad millionaire who was alone and obsessed with capturing ectoplasm on film constituted the ideal victim. So Aldaya agreed with him and encouraged him to continue with his enterprise. For weeks, Gelabert and his men shot miles of film that was then developed in different tanks using chemical solutions diluted with exotic liqueurs, red wine blessed in the Ninot Parish Church, and all kinds of cava from the Tarragona vineyards. Between screenings, Hauzard transferred powers, signed authorizations, and conferred the control of his financial reserves to Ricardo Aldaya. Hauzard vanished one November night of that year, during a storm. Nobody knows what had become of him. Apparently he was developing one of Gelabert's special rolls of film himself when he met with an accident. Don Ricardo Aldaya asked Gelabert to recover the roll. After viewing it in private, Aldaya personally opted to set fire to it. Then, with the aid of a very generous check, he suggested to the technician that he forget all about the incident. By then, Aldaya was already the owner of most of the properties belonging to the vanished Hauzard. There were those who said that the deceased Marisela had returned to take Hauzard with her to hell. Others pointed out that a beggar, who greatly resembled the deceased millionaire, was seen for a few months afterwards in the grounds of the Ciudadela Park, until a black carriage with drawn curtains ran over him in the middle of the day, without bothering to stop. The story spread. The dark legend of the rambling mansion, like the invasion of Cuban music in the city's dance halls, could not be contained. A few months later, Don Ricardo Aldaya moved his family into the house in Avenida del Tibidabo, where 2 weeks after their arrival, the couple's youngest child, Penelope, was born. To celebrate the occasion, Aldaya renamed the house Villa Penelope. The new name, however, never stuck. The house had its own character and proved immune to the influence of its new owners. The recent arrivals complained about noises and banging on the walls at night, sudden putrid smells and freezing drafts that seemed to roam through the house like wandering sentinels. The mansion was a compendium of mysteries. It had a double basement with a sort of crypt, as yet unused, on the lower level. On the higher floor, a chapel was dominated by a large polychrome figure of the crucified Christ, which the servants thought looked disturbingly like Rasputin, a very popular character in the press of the time. The books in the library were constantly being mysteriously rearranged or turned back to front. There was a room on the third floor, a bedroom that was never used because of the unaccountable damp stains that showed up on the walls and seemed to form blurry faces, where fresh flowers would wilt in just a few minutes and where you could always hear the drone of flies, although it was impossible to see them. The cook swore that certain items, such as sugar, disappeared from the larder as if by magic, and that the milk took on a red hue at every new moon. Occasionally, they found dead birds at the doors of some of the rooms, or small rodents. Other times, things went missing, especially jewels and buttons from clothes kept in cupboards and drawers. Sometimes the missing objects would mysteriously reappear months later in remote corners of the house or buried in the garden. But usually they were never found again. Don Ricardo was of the opinion that these incidents were nothing but pranks and nonsense. In his view, a week's fasting would have curbed his family's fears. What he didn't regard so philosophically were the thefts of his dear wife's jewellery. More than five maids were sacked when different items from the lady's jewellery box disappeared, though they all cried their hearts out, swearing they were innocent. Those in the know tended to think there was no mystery involved. The explanation lay in Don Ricardo's regrettable habit of slipping into the bedrooms of the younger maids at midnight for some extramarital fun and games. His reputation in this field was almost as notorious as his fortune, and there were those who said that, at the rate his exploits were taking place, the illegitimate children he left behind would be able to organise their own union. The fact was that not only jewels disappeared, in time the family lost its joie de vivre entirely. The Aldaya family was never happy in the house that had been acquired through Don Ricardo's dark arts of negotiation. Signora Aldaya pleaded constantly with her husband to sell the property and move them to a home in the town, or even return to the residence that Puigi Cadafalch had built for Grandfather Simon, the patriarch of the clan. Ricardo Aldaya flatly refused. Since he spent most of his time travelling or in the family's factories, he saw no problem with the house. On one occasion, little Jorge disappeared for 8 hours inside the mansion. His mother and the servants looked for him desperately, but without success. When he reappeared, pale and dazed, he said he'd been in the library the whole time, in the company of a mysterious black woman who had been showing him old photographs and had told him that all the women in the family would die in that house to atone for the sins of the men. The mysterious woman even revealed to little Jorge the date on which his mother would die, the 12th of April, 1921. Needless to say, the so-called black lady was never found. But years later, on the 12th of April, 1921, at first light, Signora Aldaya would be discovered lifeless on her bed. All her jewels had disappeared. When the pond in the courtyard was drained, one of the servant boys found them in the mud at the bottom, next to a doll that had belonged to her daughter, Penelope. A week later, Don Ricardo Aldaya decided to get rid of the house. By then, his financial empire was already in its death throes, and there were those who insinuated that it was all due to that accursed house, which brought misfortune to whoever occupied it. Others, the more cautious ones, simply asserted that Aldaya had never understood the changing trends of the market, and that all he had accomplished during his lifetime was to ruin the robust business created by the patriarch Simon. Ricardo Aldaya announced that he was leaving Barcelona and moving with his family to Argentina, where his textile industries were allegedly doing splendidly. Many believed he was fleeing from failure and shame. In 1922, the Angel of Mist was put up for sale at a ridiculously low price. At first, there was strong interest in buying it, as much for its notoriety as for the growing prestige of the neighbourhood. But none of the potential buyers made an offer after visiting the house. In 1923, the mansion was closed. The deed was transferred to a real estate company high up on the long list of Aldaya's creditors, so that it could arrange for its sale or demolition. The house was on the market for years, but the firm was unable to find a buyer. The said company, Hotel y Joffre went bankrupt in 1939 when its two partners were sent to prison on unknown charges. After the unexplained fatal accident that befell both men in the San Vicens jail in 1940, it was taken over by a financial group among whose shareholders were three fascist generals and a Swiss banker. This company's executive director turned out to be a certain Signor Aguilar, father of Tomás and Bea. Despite all their efforts, none of Signor Aguilar's salesmen were able to place the house, not even by offering it far beneath its already low asking price. Nobody had been back to the property for over 10 years. "Until today," said Bea quietly, withdrawing into herself for a moment. "I wanted to show you this place, you see. I wanted to give you a surprise. I told myself I had to bring you here, because this was part of your story, the story of Carax and Penelope. I borrowed the key from my father's office. Nobody knows we're here. It's our secret. I wanted to share it with you. And I was asking myself whether you'd come.
You knew I would."
She smiled as she nodded. "I believe that nothing happens by chance. Deep down, things have their own secret plan, even though we don't understand it. Like you finding that novel by Julián Carax in the Cemetery of Forgotten Books, or the fact that you and I are here now, in this house that belonged to the Aldayas. It's all part of something we cannot comprehend, something that owns us." While she spoke, my hand had slipped awkwardly down to Bea's ankle and was sliding towards her knee. She watched it as if she were watching an insect climbing up her leg. I asked myself what Fermín would have done at that moment. Where was his wisdom when I needed it most? "Tomás says you've never had a girlfriend," said Bea, as if that explained me. I removed my hand and looked down defeated. I thought Bea was smiling, but I preferred not to check. "Considering he's so quiet, your brother is turning out to be quite a big mouth. What else does the newsreel say about me?" "He says that for years you were in love with an older woman and that the experience left you broken-hearted."
"All I had broken was a lip and my pride."
"Tomás says you haven't been out with any other girl since then because you compare them all with that woman."
Good old Tomás and his hidden blows. "Her name is Clara," I proffered.
"I know, Clara Barceló."
"Do you know her?"
"Everyone knows someone like Clara Barceló. The name is the least of it."
We fell silent for a while, watching the fire crackle.
"After I left you, I wrote a letter to Pablo," said Bea.
I swallowed hard.
"To your lieutenant boyfriend? What for?"
Bea took an envelope out of her blouse and showed it to me. It was closed and sealed.
"In the letter, I told him I wanted us to get married very soon, in a month's time, if possible, and that I want to leave Barcelona forever."
Almost trembling, I faced her impenetrable eyes.
"Why are you telling me this?"
"Because I want you to tell me whether I should send it or not. That's why I've asked you to come here today, Daniel." I examined the envelope that she twirled in her hand like a playing card.
"Look at me," she said.
I raised my eyes and met her gaze. I didn't know what to answer. Bea lowered her eyes and walked away towards the end of the gallery. A door led to the marble balustrade that opened onto the inner courtyard of the house. I watched her silhouette fade into the rain. I went after her and stopped her, snatching the envelope from her hands. The rain beat down on her face, sweeping away the tears and the anger. I led her back into the mansion to the heat of the blaze. She avoided my eyes. I took the envelope and threw it into the flames. We watched the letter breaking up among the hot coals and the pages evaporating in spirals of smoke, one by one. Bea knelt down next to me with tears in her eyes. I embraced her and felt her breath on my throat.
"Don't let me fall, Daniel," she murmured.
The wisest man I ever knew, Fermín Romero de Torres, once told me that there was no experience in life comparable to the first time you undress a woman. For all this wisdom, though he had not lied to me, he hadn't told me the complete truth either. He hadn't told me anything about that strange trembling of the hands that turned every button, every zip, into a superhuman challenge. Nor had he told me about that bewitchment of pale, tremulous skin, that first brush of the lips, or about the mirage that seemed to shimmer from every pore of the skin. He didn't tell me any of that because he knew that the miracle happened only once, and when it did, it spoke in a language of secrets that, were they disclosed, would vanish again forever. 1,000 times I've wanted to recover that first afternoon with Bea in the rambling house on Avenida del Tibidabo, when the sound of the rain washed the whole world away with it. 1,000 times I've wished to return and lose myself in a memory from which I can rescue only one image stolen from the heat of the flames. Bea, naked and glistening with rain, lying by the fire, with open eyes that have followed me since that day. I leaned over her and passed the tips of my fingers over her belly. Bea lowered her eyelids and smiled, confident and strong. "Do what you like to me," she whispered. She was 17, her entire life shining before her. Chapter 29. Darkness enveloped us in shadow as we left the mansion. The storm was receding, now barely an echo of cold rain. I wanted to return the key to Bea, but her eyes told me she wanted me to be the one to keep it. We strolled down towards Paseo de San Gervasio, hoping to find a taxi or a bus. We walked in silence, holding hands and hardly looking at one another. "I won't be able to see you again until Tuesday," said Bea in a tremulous voice, as if she suddenly doubted my desire to see her again. "I'll be waiting for you here," I said. I took for granted that all my meetings with Bea would take place between the walls of that rambling old house, that the rest of the city did not belong to us. It even seemed to me that the firmness of her touch decreased as we moved away, that her strength and warmth diminished with every step we took. When we reached the avenue, we realized that the streets were almost deserted. "We won't find anything here," said Bea. "We'd better go down along Balms." We started off briskly down Calle Balms, walking under the trees to shelter from the drizzle. It seemed to me that Bea was quickening her pace at every step, almost dragging me along. For a moment I thought that if I let go of her hand, Bea would start to run. My imagination, still intoxicated by her touch and her taste, burned with a desire to corner her on a bench, to seek her lips, and recite a predictable string of nonsense that would have made anyone within hearing burst out laughing. Anyone but me. But Bea was withdrawing into herself again, fading a world away from me. "What's the matter?" I murmured. She gave me a broken smile, full of fear and loneliness. I then saw myself through her eyes, just an innocent boy who thought he had conquered the world in an hour, but didn't realize he could lose it again in an instant. I kept on walking, without expecting an answer, waking up at last. Soon we heard the rumble of traffic, and the air seemed to ignite with the heat from the street lamps and traffic lights. They made me think of invisible walls. "We'd better separate here," said Bea, letting go of my hand. The lights from a taxi rank could be seen on the corner, a procession of glowworms. "As you wish." Bea leaned over and brushed my cheek with her lips. Her hair still smelled of candle wax. "Bea," I began almost inaudibly, "I love you." She shook her head but said nothing, sealing my lips with her hand as if my words were wounding her. "Tuesday at 6, all right?" she asked. I nodded again. I saw her leave and disappear into a taxi, almost a stranger. One of the drivers who had followed the exchange, as if he were an umpire, observed me with curiosity. "What do you say? Shall we head for home, Chief?" I got into the taxi without thinking. The taxi driver's eyes examined me through the mirror. I lost sight of the car that was taking Bea away, two dots of light sinking into a well of darkness. I didn't manage to get to sleep until dawn cast 100 tones of dismal grey on my bedroom window. Fermin woke me up, throwing tiny pebbles at my window from the church square. I put on the first thing I could find and ran down to open the door for him. Fermin was full of the insufferable enthusiasm of the early bird. We pushed up the shop grills and hung up the open sign.
"Look at those rings under your eyes, Daniel. They're as big as a building site. We may assume the owl got the pussycat to go out to sea with him."
I went to the back room, put on my blue apron and handed Fermin his, or rather threw it at him angrily. Fermin caught it in mid-flight with a sly smile.
"The owl drowned, period. Happy?" I snapped. "Intriguing metaphor. Have you been dusting off your verlaine, young man?"
"I stick to prose on Monday mornings. What do you want me to tell you?"
"I'll leave that up to you, the number of estocadas, or the lapse of honour."
"I'm not in the mood, Fermin."
"Oh, youth, flower of fools. Well, don't get irritated with me. I have fresh news concerning our investigation on your friend Julian Carax."
"I'm all ears." He gave me one of his cloak and dagger looks, one eyebrow raised.
"Well, it turns out that yesterday, after leaving Bernarda back home with her virtue intact, but a nice couple of well-placed bruises on her backside, I was assailed by a fit of insomnia due to the evening's erotic arousals, which gave me the pretext to walk down to one of the information centres of Barcelona's underworld, i.e. the tavern of Eleodoro Safelman, a.k.a. Cold Prick, situated in a seedy but rather colourful establishment on Calle San Jeroni, a pride of the Raval quarter."
"The abridged version, Fermin, for goodness sake."
"Coming. The fact is that once I was there, ingratiating myself with some of the usual crowd, old chums from troubled times of yore, I began to make inquiries about this Michel Moliner, the husband of your Matahari Nuria Montfort, and a supposed inmate at the local penitential."
"Supposed?"
"With a capital S. There are no slips at all, twixt cup and lip in this case, if you see what I mean. I know from experience that when it comes to the census of the prison population, my informants in Cold Prick's tabernacle are much more accurate than the pencil pushers in the law courts. I can guarantee, Daniel, my friend, that nobody has heard mention of the name Michel Moliner as an inmate, visitor, or any other living soul in the prisons of Barcelona for at least 10 years.
Perhaps he's serving in some other prison."
"Yes, Alcatraz, Sing Sing, or the Bastille. Daniel, that woman lied to you."
"I suppose she did."
"Don't suppose, accept it."
"So what now? Michel Moliner is a dead end?"
"Or this Nuria is very crafty."
"What are you suggesting?"
"At the moment, we must explore other avenues. It wouldn't be a bad idea to call on the good nanny in the story the priest foisted on us yesterday morning."
"Don't tell me you think that the governess has vanished too."
"No, but I do think it's time we stopped fussing about and knocking on doors as if we were begging for alms. In this line of business, you have to go in through the back door. Are you with me?"
"You know that I worship the ground you walk on."
"Well then, start dusting your altar boy costume. This afternoon, as soon as we've closed the shop, we're going to make a charitable visit to the old lady in the hospice of Santa Lucia. And now tell me, how did it go yesterday with the young filly? Don't be secretive. If you hold back, may you sprout virulent pimples."
I sighed in defeat and made my confession, down to the last detail. At the end of my narrative, after listing what I was sure were just the existential anxieties of a moronic schoolboy, Fermin surprised me with a sudden heartfelt hug.
"You're in love,"
he mumbled, full of emotion, patting me on the back. "Poor kid." That afternoon, we left the bookshop precisely at closing time, a move that earned us a steely look from my father, who was beginning to suspect that we were involved in some shady business, with all this coming and going. Fermin mumbled something incoherent about a few errands that needed doing, and we quickly disappeared. I told myself that sooner or later, I'd have to reveal at least part of all this mess to my father, which part exactly was a different question. On our way, with his usual flair for tales, Fermín briefed me on where we were heading. The Santa Lucia Hospice was an institution of dubious reputation, housed within the ruins of an ancient palace on Calle Moncada. The legend surrounding the place made it sound like a cross between purgatory and a morgue, with sanitary conditions worse than either. The story was, to say the very least, peculiar. Since the 11th century, the palace had been home to, among other things, various well-to-do families, a prison, a salon for courtesans, a library of forbidden manuscripts, a barracks, a sculptor's workshop, a sanatorium for plague sufferers, and a convent. In the middle of the 19th century, when it was practically crumbling to bits, the palace had been turned into a museum exhibiting circus freaks and other atrocities by a bombastic impresario who called himself Laszlo de Vicerny, Duke of Parma and private alchemist to the House of Bourbon. His real name turned out to be Baltasar de Lofeo y Carolot, the bastard son of a salted pork entrepreneur and a fallen debutante who was mostly known for his escapades as a professional gigolo and con artist. The man took pride in owning Spain's largest collection of human fetuses in different stages of deformity, preserved in jars of embalming fluid, and somewhat less pride in his even larger collection of warrants issued by some of Europe's and America's finest law enforcement agencies. Among other attractions, the Tenebrarium, as Delofeo had renamed the palace, offered seances, necromancy, fights with cocks, rats, dogs, big strapping women, imbeciles, or some combination of the above, as well as betting, a brothel that specialised in cripples and freaks, a casino, a legal and financial consultancy, a workshop for love potions, regional folklore and puppet shows, and parades of exotic dances. At Christmas, a nativity play was staged, sparing no expense, and featuring the troupe from the museum and the entire collection of prostitutes. Its fame reached the far ends of the province. The Tenebrarium was a roaring success for 15 years, until it was discovered that Delofeo had seduced the wife, the daughter, and the mother-in-law of the military governor of the province within a single week. The blackest infamy descended on the place and its owner. Before Delofeo was able to flee the city and don another of his multiple identities, a band of masked thugs seized him in the back streets of the Santa Maria Quarter and proceeded to hang him and set fire to him in the Ciudadela Park, leaving his body to be devoured by the wild dogs that roamed the area. After 2 decades of neglect, during which time nobody bothered to remove the collection of horrors belonging to the ill-fated Laszlo, the Tenebrarium was transformed into a charitable institution under the care of an order of nuns. "The ladies of the final ordeal, or something equally morbid," said Fermín. "The trouble is, they're very obsessive about the secrecy of the place, and bad conscience, I'd say, which means we'll have to think of some ruse for getting in." In more recent times, the occupants of the Hospice of Santa Lucia were being recruited from the ranks of dying, abandoned, demented, destitute old people who made up the crowded underworld of Barcelona. Luckily for them, they mostly lasted only a short time after they had been taken in. Neither the conditions of the establishment nor the company encouraged longevity. According to Fermín, the deceased were removed shortly before dawn and made their last journey to the communal grave in a covered wagon donated by a firm in Hospitalet that specialised in meat packing and rather dubious delicatessen products, a firm that occasionally would be involved in grim scandals. "You're making all of this up," I protested, overwhelmed by the horrific details of Fermín's story. "My inventiveness does not go that far, Daniel. Wait and see. I visited the building on one unfortunate occasion about 10 years ago, and I can tell you that it looked as if they'd hired your friend Julián Carax as an interior decorator. A shame we didn't bring some laurel leaves to stifle the aromas, but we'll have enough trouble as it is, just being allowed in." With my expectations thus shaped, we turned into Calle Moncada, by that time of day already transformed into a dark passage flanked by old mansions that had been turned into storehouses and workshops. The litany of bells coming from the Basilica of Santa Maria del Mar mingled with the echo of our footsteps. Soon a penetrating, bitter odour permeated the cold winter breeze.
"What's that smell?"
"We've arrived," announced Fermin.
Chapter 30. A front door of rotted wood led us into a courtyard guarded by gas lamps that flickered above gargoyles and angels, their features disintegrating on the old stone. A staircase led to the first floor, where a rectangle of light marked the main entrance to the hospice. The gaslight radiating from this opening gave an ochre tone to the miasma that emanated from within. An angular, predatory figure observed us coolly from the shadows of the door, her eyes the same colour as her habit. She held a steaming wooden bucket that gave off an indescribable stench.
"Hail Mary, full of grace, conceived without sin!" Fermin called out enthusiastically.
"Where's the coffin?"
answered the voice from up high, serious and taciturn.
"Coffin?"
Fermin and I replied in unison.
"Aren't you from the Undertakers?"
asked the nun in a weary voice. I wondered whether that was a comment on our appearance or a genuine question. Fermin's face lit up at such a providential opportunity.
The coffin is in the van. First, we'd like to examine the customer. A pure technicality.
I felt overpowered by nausea.
"I thought Signor Colbatto was going to come in person," said the nun.
"Signor Colbatto begs to be excused, but a rather complicated embalming has cropped up at the last moment. A circus strongman."
"Do you work with Signor Colbatto in the funeral parlour?"
"Where his right and left hands, respectively.
Wilfred the Hairy at your service, and here at my side my apprentice and student, Sansón Carrasco." "Pleased to meet you," I rounded off. The nun gave us a brief looking over and nodded, indifferent to the pair of scarecrows reflected in her eyes.
"Welcome to Santa Lucia. I'm Sister Hortensia, the one who called you. Follow me."
We followed Sister Hortensia without a word through a cavernous corridor whose smell reminded me of the subway tunnels. It was flanked by doorless frames through which you could make out candlelit halls filled with rows of beds, piled up against the wall and covered with mosquito nets that moved in the air like shrouds. I could hear groans and see glimpses of human shapes through the netting.
"This way,"
Sister Hortensia beckoned, a few yards ahead of us. We entered a wide vault, which I had no difficulty in imagining as the stage for the tenebrarium described by Fermin. The darkness obscured what at first seemed like a collection of wax figures, sitting or abandoned in corners, with dead glassy eyes that shone like tin coins in the candlelight. I thought that perhaps they were dolls or the remains of the old museum. Then I realised that they were moving, though very slowly, even stealthily. It was impossible to tell their age or gender, the rags covering them with a colour of ash.
"Signor Colbatto said not to touch or clean anything,"
said Sister Hortensia, looking slightly apologetic.
"We just placed the poor thing in one of the boxes that was lying around here because he was beginning to drip."
"You did the right thing.
You can't be too careful," agreed Fermin. I threw him a despairing look. He shook his head calmly, indicating that I should leave him in charge of the situation. Sister Hortensia led us to what appeared to be a cell with no ventilation or light, at the end of a narrow passage. She took one of the gas lamps that hung from the wall and handed it to us.
"Will you be long? I'm rather busy."
"Don't worry about us. You get on with your things and we'll take him away."
"All right. If you need anything, I'll be down in the basement, in the ward for the bedridden.
If it's not too much bother, take him out through the back door.
Don't let the others see him. It's bad for the patient's morale."
"We quite understand,"
I said in a faltering voice. Sister Hortensia gazed at me for a moment with vague curiosity. When I saw her more closely,
I noticed that she was quite an age herself, almost an elderly woman. Few years separated her from the rest of the hospice's guests.
"Listen, isn't the apprentice a bit young for this sort of work?" she asked.
"The truths of life know no age, sister," remarked Fermin. The nun nodded and smiled at me sweetly. There was no suspicion in that look, only sadness.
"Even so," she murmured.
She wandered off into the shadows, carrying her bucket and dragging her shadow like a bridal veil. Fermin pushed me into the cell. It was a dismal, claustrophobic room, built into the walls of a cave that sweated with damp. Chains ending in hooks hung from the ceiling, and the cracked floor was broken up by a sewage grating. In the centre of the room, on a greyish marble table, was a wooden crate for industrial packaging. Fermin raised the lamp, and we caught a glimpse of the deceased nestling between the straw padding. Parchment features, incomprehensible, jagged and frozen. The swollen skin was purple. The eyes were open, white, like broken eggshells. The sight made my stomach turn and I looked away.
"Come on, let's get down to work," ordered Fermin. "Are you mad? I mean, we have to find this Jacinta woman before we're found out." "How? How do you think? By asking."
We peered into the corridor to make sure Sister Hortensia had vanished. Then we scurried back to the hall we had previously crossed. The wretched figures were still observing us, with looks that ranged from curiosity to fear and, in some cases, to greed. "Watch it. Some of these would suck your blood if they thought it would make them any younger," said Fermin. "Age makes them all look as meek as lambs, but there are as many sons of bitches in here as out there, or more, because these are the ones who have lasted and buried the rest. Don't feel sorry for them. Go on. Begin with those ones in the corner. They look harmless enough." If those words were meant to give me courage for the mission, they failed miserably. I looked at the group of human remains that languished in the corner and smiled at them. It occurred to me that their very presence was testimony to the moral emptiness of the universe and the mechanical brutality with which it destroys the parts it no longer needs. Fermin seemed able to read these profound thoughts and nodded gravely. "Mother Nature is the meanest of bitches, that's the sad truth," he said. "Go on, be brave." My first round of inquiries as to the whereabouts of Jacinta Coronado produced only empty looks, groans, burps and ravings. 15 minutes later, I called it a day and joined Fermin to see whether he'd had better luck. His disappointment was all too obvious. "How are we going to find Jacinta Coronado in this shithole?"
"I don't know. It's a cauldron of idiots. I've tried the sugar sweet trick, but they seem to think they're suppositories."
"What if we ask Sister Hortensia? We tell her the truth and have done with it." "Telling the truth should be our last resort, Daniel, even more so when you're dealing with a nun. Let's use up all our powder first. Look at that little group over there. They seem quite jolly. I'm sure they're very articulate. Go and question them."
"And what are you planning to do?" "I'll keep watch, in case the penguin returns. You get on with your business."
With little or no hope of success, I went up to the group of patients occupying another corner of the room.
"Good evening,"
I said, realising instantly how absurd my greeting was because in there it was always night time.
"I'm looking for Signora Jacinta Coronado. Coronado. Do any of you know her, or could you tell me where to find her?"
I was confronted by four faces corrupted by greed. There's something here, I thought. Maybe all's not lost.
"Jacinta Coronado," I insisted.
The four patients exchanged looks and nodded to each other. One of them, a pot-bellied man without a single hair on his body, seemed to be their leader. His appearance and manner made me think of a happy Nero plucking his harp while Rome rotted at his feet. With a majestic gesture, the Nero figure smiled at me playfully. I returned the smile hopefully. The man gestured at me to come closer, as if he wanted to whisper something in my ear. I hesitated, then leaned forward. I lent my ear to the patient's lips, so close that I could feel his fetid warm breath on my skin. "Can you tell me where I can find Signora Jacinta Coronado?" I asked for the last time. I was afraid he'd bite me. Instead, he emitted a violently loud fart. His companions burst out laughing and clapped with joy. I took a few steps back, but it was too late. The flatulent vapours had already hit me. It was then that I noticed, close to me, an old man all hunched up, with a prophet's beard, thin hair, and fiery eyes, who was leaning on a walking stick and gazing at the others with disdain.
"You're wasting your time, young man. Juanito only knows how to let off farts, and the others can only laugh and smell them. As you see, the social structure here isn't very different from that of the outside world."
The ancient philosopher spoke in a solemn voice and with perfect diction. He looked me up and down, taking the measure of me.
"You're looking for Jacinta?"
I nodded, astounded by the appearance of intelligent life in that den of horrors.
"And what for?"
"I'm her grandson."
"And I'm the Marquis of Creme Brulee. You're a terrible liar, that's what you are. Tell me why you want to see her, or I'll play the madman. It's easy here. And if you intend to ask these poor wretches one by one, you'll soon see what I mean."
Juanito and his gang of inhalers were still howling with laughter. The soloist then gave off an encore, more muted and prolonged than the previous one. It sounded like a hiss, like a punctured tyre, and proved Juanito's virtuoso control over his sphincter. I yielded to the facts. "You're right, I'm not a relative of Signora Coronado, but I need to speak to her. It's a matter of the utmost importance." The old man came up to me. He had a wicked, cat-like smile, the smile of a mischievous child, and his eyes were full of cunning.
"Can you help me?"
I begged.
"That depends on how much you can help me."
"If it's in my power, I'd be delighted to help you. Would you like me to deliver a message to your family?" The old man laughed bitterly.
"My family were the ones who stuck me in this hole. They're a load of leeches. They'd steal my underpants while they're still warm. To hell with them. I've kept them and put up with them for long enough. What I want is a woman."
"Excuse me?" The old man looked at me impatiently.
"Being young is no excuse for slow wit, child. I'm telling you, I want a woman, a female, a maid, or a well-bred young filly. Young, under 55, that is, and healthy, with no sores or fractures."
"I'm not sure if I understand."
"You understand me perfectly. I want to have it off with a woman who has teeth and won't pee on me before I depart for the other world. I don't mind whether she's good-looking or not. I'm half blind, and at my age, any girl who has anything to hold on to is a Venus. Am I making myself clear?"
"Crystal, but I don't see how I'm going to find a woman for..."
"When I was your age, there was something in the service sector called Ladies of Easy Virtue. I know the world changes, but never in essence. Find one for me. Plump and fun-loving, and we'll do business. And if you're asking yourself about my ability to enjoy a woman, I want you to know I'm quite content to pinch her backside and feel up her bumpers. That's the advantage of experience."
"Technicalities are your affair, sir, but I can't bring a woman to you here right now."
"I might be a dirty old man, but I'm not stupid, I know that. Your promise is good enough for me."
"And how do you know I won't say yes just to get you to tell me where Jacinta Coronado is?"
The old man gave me a sly smile. "You give me your word and leave any problems of conscience to me."
I looked around me. Juanito was starting on the second half of his recital. Hope was ebbing away. Fulfilling this horny granddad's request seemed to be the only thing that made any sense in that purgatory.
"I give you my word. I'll do what I can."
The old man smiled from ear to ear. I counted three teeth.
"Blonde, even if it's peroxide. pneumatically endowed and good at talking dirty, if possible. Of all the senses, the one that still works the best is my hearing.
I'll see what I can do. Now, tell me where I can find Jacinto Coronado.